CTSNet friends. Welcome to this August edition of the CTSNet Beat podcast. My name is Joel Dunning, and I go through everything that's new and good and great in the world of cardiothoracic surgery. And we've really got a wide variety of topics for you today. We've got myth busting in aortic surgery about certain antibiotics. Can they cause dissections or aneurysms? We've got two really good videos on aortic debranching and also replacing the aorta without deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. In the world of thoracic surgery, how to do thoracic surgery without a drain. Eric Lim from Brompton tells us all about how to do that. And Sunny Side introduces an amazing guest editor series all about minimally invasive pediatric surgery. So don't go away. We're going to get straight into it with the CTSNet Beat podcast. Got three great JAMS news items for you, selected as the best that we've found on the internet. And the very first one we've got is entitled The First Auto-Regulated Total Artificial Heart Implant in the United States. This is the CARMAT Total Artificial Heart. It's actually called Eson now. This is a French company, and I've been following this for a while. Alain Carpentier, who you must all know, in fact, in 2008 had this amazing concept to do a completely new artificial heart. His concept, because he was from the world of biological valves and repair, you know, don't put metal in the circulation. He came up with this amazing concept. Why don't we have a total artificial heart completely surrounded with pericardium? So if the chambers are pericardium, then surely that'll be less thrombotic. We won't have to anticoagulate them. And really, that is the bane of mechanical hearts, is having to keep the blood really thin, and then they get bleeds. And so this just sounded like an amazing concept. And he has been working on it. He's 90 now, but they then set up a French company. They've been working on it for quite a few years. In 2021, they had to recall it because there were some technical problems with the pericardium. But it has now got investigatory approval for research purposes. And then the team at Duke University Medical Center have published an Annals of Thoracic Surgery short report that you can read right now. Carmelo Milano is the senior author, and basically they are presenting their first experience of the new version. So the person that they're particularly talking about is a 39-year-old. They had diabetes, terrible biventricular failure from ischemic cardiomyopathy. The ejection fraction was 15. He'd had gone into VF, he needed ECMO, he had Impellerin, and they were ineligible for a transplant because of size criteria and several other criteria, just too ill. So this person was deemed for research purposes to be eligible for the CARMAT total artificial heart. So they put this in, they did a CT to make sure the chest cavity was big enough, and it was. They basically cut out the heart, leaving the mitral annulus and the tricuspid annulus. You then sew two rings to this. You then do a second layer for hemostatic. Then you twist the artificial heart in. And actually, if you want to see this, there's some really good video and figure abstracts in this article. So check the links below. And I found it really fascinating to see this very novel concept. The actual bypass time was only 3 hours 50, which I thought was quite good, really, for a total artificial heart. The operation took 7 hours. They sort of gradually ramped up the flow and got the patient off bypass, which is really good. They needed a few vasopressors. And the really good thing is that in the first 30 days, there was literally only one alarm, and it was very transient. So it was very good and safe. The particular interesting thing is that it's got an inflow sensor. So if it has higher inflow pressures, it ups the cardiac output. So that's really good, responsive to the physiological parameters in the body, which I thought was very impressive. This patient actually got home day 70, but got home. And then 8 months later, this patient was eligible for a heart transplant, had a heart transplant, and is doing well now. So congratulations, what an amazing achievement. It is the holy grail, a total artificial heart that really is functional for a decent decent amount of time. I think this biocompatible big piece of pericardium in both chambers does look really impressive. So check out that article. And I think we'll be hearing a lot more from the Eson by Carmat, an amazing French company doing some great research in America as well. Congratulations to the team there. The second article we selected for you is in the world of thoracics, and this is from the Brompton, from Eric Lim, our fantastic colleague down there. The title is, Are Chest Drains Routinely Required After Thoracic Surgery? A drainology study of on-table chest drain removal. I love that word, drainology. I think that'll be pretty good in Scrabble, I think. I'm going to have to remember that one. So Eric Lim has for quite a while been connecting his uniportal operations to a Topaz system, which measures how many mils per minute come out of air leak. And this was the final report in the JTCVS Open, published this month and available now. Some good visual abstracts and a really good description of the protocol. So the really nice thing about this is he's got a 5-minute video where he personally describes the process with a video of exactly how he closes the wound around the drain, exactly how he watches until the drainage is less than 20 mils a minute. He can make sure that it's stable. When we say less than 20 mils a minute, basically that's the error around a topaz, and that's a widely regarded parameter for it basically not draining anything. Most of the time it was actually zero in this study, and so as soon as it was zero, he's got a really nice way of quickly taking the drain out. So it's a fast pull and a close, and he's already done the skin stitch, which he just pulls, closes everything, so no air sucks back in, which I really liked. And he's presented a 5-year retrospective study, 2016 to 2021, 107 patients. Now, these aren't lobectomies, but they are sublobar resections. They're quite a lot of wedge resections and a few bellectomies. And a few other little things, a few pleural effusions and things like that. But the really impressive thing is that although you could see in 20% of them some pneumothorax of some type, and that might mean just a tiny rim, 21 out of the 22 pneumothoraces that he saw, only one needed a drain. That's a 0.9% reintervention rate. That's really, really good. But the most impressive thing about this series is the average length of stay was 1 day, and 13% of people went home on the day of surgery, the same day. That's outpatient surgery. And I was really impressed with that. Now, when I went to meet Eric Lim in the Brompton, he told me about this study, and I was really impressed. And he says his next mission is to do this in lobectomies. I have seen a paper from Japan where they do that. You have to be super meticulous, you know, real fisher last, very careful, but Eric's a very careful surgeon. So if you're a careful thoracic surgeon, you know, the sky is the limit. And really the outcome measure is, have you got no bubbling at the end of the case? We sometimes push the PEEP up to 10 when we're doing drainless surgery and leave it for 20 minutes just to be absolutely sure. So yeah, give it a go. Start off in wedges. You know, this series of 107 patients should give you the real reassurance that this is a safe thing to do. So well done, Eric. And it has real patient benefits, getting people out fast, mobilizing, basically because there's less pain, because the drain causes a whole heap of pain. So well done, Eric Lim and the team from the Brompton. The third paper we have for you this week is an interesting myth-busting paper. This is from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and it's published in JAMA Cardiology this month. The title of it is Association Between Fluoroquinolones and Hospitalization with Aortic Aneurysm, Aortic Dissection. And the background to this is that there is quite a feeling that that antibiotics like ciprofloxacin and other fluoroquinolones like levofloxacin and all that cause aortic dissection. This has been sort of suggested by some quite big cohort studies. So there is a bit of a fear that using that causes dissections. I mean, a super common antibiotic. So, I mean, this is a big problem. And so the team, senior editor Ian Douglas, Jeremy Brown from this school thought, right, what can we use to try and see if this is true or not? And the answer they found was an absolutely humongous database of a UK two databases. One's called Clinical Practice Research Data Lake. Data Link. And the second one was the gold primary care records from general practitioners. In the UK, as you know, we have a big national health service. Everyone in the whole country has all their data put on a national database. And so they could link this to admissions, and they can look on our national database for admissions, what the cause of admission is, and if it's an aortic dissection or aneurysm, you can pair them up. So between 1997 and 2019, they analysed, wait for these numbers, 3,134 patients and 121. That is a lot of patients, 3 million patients. Another 500,000 patients from the second database of admissions, and they linked use of these antibiotics with association with dissection. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at the crude people with antibiotics, did they get more dissections or aneurysms? The answer was actually yes. The hazard ratio is 1.28. The lower part of the confidence interval is 1.13. And the p-value was like off the scale, tiny. But then they looked at all the confounders. And actually, once you look at loads of confounders, like people that have antibiotics are frailer and have more comorbidities, because why should antibiotics cause dissections? Whereas frailer people with comorbidities might just get antibiotics, then this disappears. They found 84,000 people with aneurysms or dissections. This is not a small study. You know, you can't do RCTs in this thing. So this is an amazing study using giant databases to get the correct answer. So the correct answer is that actually, if you look at fluoroquinolones compared to other antibiotics like trimethoprim, you do have a slightly increased risk of dissection. But if you bring in all the other risk factors of people being iller and frailer because they just get infections, then that disappears. So they say the overall finding is that this is a myth and not a fact, probably due to confounders. You don't have to worry. I quite like that. And the main thing I liked about that is the use of giant databases that are not randomized trials that get the answer. There are some things out there you can't get randomized trials, but massive database analysis can really get the answers to even some really rare and strange associations. So well done, really interesting paper. Check it in the links below if you want to learn more. So we're going to talk now about the videos, but first I'll hand you over to the CTSnet team, who will tell you what you can find on the CTSnet website this week.
Are you on the lookout for a new job in cardiothoracic surgery? Hundreds of open positions are waiting for you at CTSNet's Career Center. Through ctsnet.org, you can browse jobs and sign up for custom job alerts direct to your inbox. For an even more enhanced experience, create a free account and upload your resume so employers and recruiters can find you. Happy job hunting! Now, back to the beat.
We have three really good videos for you on the site this week. And if you've got a video, please do send it in and we'd love to showcase your videos. Remember, this is just a posting, so it doesn't stop you submitting it for a full paper publication. But if you think you've got something interesting to show the world, we've got 40,000 surgeon members and a very wide reach around the world, so send them in. So the first video we've got for you, I think, is absolutely fascinating. It's an aortic surgery video, and the title is Aortic Arch Debranching, an Off-Pump Technique. This is by Stephen Spindle and Shinobu Itagaki from the Mount Sinai Amazing Medical Center in New York in America. The case is in a 61-year-old patient, male smoker, who had a type B aortic dissection, treated conservatively 3 months prior, but it started getting bigger. Presented again, and the descending aorta in the thoracic aorta was now 4.7 centimeters when it was 3.3 before. This was getting bigger and bigger really rapidly, so something had to be done. But this person's very high risk. So what did they do? Well, they did a two-stage operation. Well, first, they wanted to connect the aorta to the innominate and the left carotid. So stenotomy, create a Y graft, then anastomose with a side biting clamp on the, as proximal on the aorta as possible, the proximal anastomosis of the 10 millimeter Dacron graft, then put a piece of wire around it because we're going to go and do a TVAR after this. The whole point is to get a landing zone, but the landing zone has to be beyond the head and neck vessel. So put a piece of wire so you can see on fluoroscopy later. And then you've got your aortic proximal anastomosis, no, totally off pump. And then one at a time, They clamped the innominate, then they anastomosed the innominate to the first part of the Y graft, and then unclamped that, reperfused the innominate. And then the second part is clamp the left carotid, and then anastomose that. So you've got your Y graft, the innominate, and the left carotid. Then close the sternum, and then the next bit is you're going to do a left carotid to subclavian bypass. So now you've got all your three head and neck vessels perfused, so you now don't need any of the branches of the head and neck vessels. And then finally you can go and do your TVAR as the second stage procedure. So really good idea. Check it out for all the details and a beautiful video of how to do that. And I thought a really nice companion video to that is a second aortic video done in a very different way, because this is by Marco Di Usanio from the Cardiac Surgery Center Polyclinic in Ancona in Italy. And he went and did a presentation at ATAS, the Australian Aortic Symposium, just this spring in 2023. And this is a beautiful presentation of frozen elephant trunk without deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. Now I hear you say, wow, changing a whole arch without circulatory arrest. And again, he does do at the start of this presentation, which is only 15 minutes long, very much worth your time watching it. But at the very start, he goes through what a wonderful thing deep hypothermic circulatory arrest has been for our specialty. This is allowed surgery in all the aortic arch operations. But he then goes on to say, why haven't we progressed? Because it causes a lot of comorbidity. The number one risk factor for aortic arch surgery is the presence of circulatory arrest. So maybe it's in our minds that we haven't wanted to progress and try and get away from it or avoid circulatory arrest. But he shows us how you can do this really easily. So he's got a patient with a big aortic arch aneurysm. So the first thing he does is he does a hybrid technique. So he lands a TVAR really nicely, just distal to the left subclavian artery. And I think this was part of the key to the coolness of this technique. So he then does a sternotomy. He does innominate artery cannulation through the sternotomy, not through an axillary artery approach. He then does a femoral artery cannulation as well and puts them together. So you've got innominate and femoral cannulation. He then passes a balloon up the TVAR and he can inflate it to occlude the descending aorta. So you've got femoral artery cannulation perfusing everything, the whole lower body, and then we can clamp proximal to the innominate. So the innominate's now doing the head, the femoral one's doing the rest of the body. So you've got the head and the rest of the body perfused, you've got all the important organs perfused. So now you can clamp off all the head and neck vessels, you can cross clamp the heart and plege it, put it to sleep, and you can now replace the whole aortic arch. So, and he proceeds to do this. So he cuts off the innominate, the left carotid and subclavian. He actually does a Bentalls with a biological valve. He then sutures to the actual TVAR. You actually see him suturing to that, which is really impressive. Anastomoses it all together and then gets them off bypass. Normothermic. I mean, he drifted a little bit, but you know, 32 degrees. That, I think that was absolutely amazing. So no circulatory arrest. So no mucking about with pH, no selective cerebral perfusions. You know, I think much less of an insult to a patient. And I think that is just genius. So if you can land a TVAR first, because I think you need that to inflate the balloon distally, then I think you can do this. What a great technique. So well done, Marco Di Usanio, for an absolutely wonderful technique. And the last video that we've got here for you is actually probably my favourite of the week, from our own very wonderful Sammy Syed from Westchester Medical Center and our congenital senior editor. He has got together an amazing paediatric guest editor series. He's brought together some of the very best paediatric surgeons who are at the frontier of non-sternotomy, minimally invasive congenital heart surgery. And And he's also done a webinar that you can find on the link below. So he starts off this webinar basically admitting that in paediatrics, they've lagged behind a little bit on minimally invasive surgery. But actually, there are loads of things you can do with minimally invasive surgery. You can do ASDs, you can do VSDs, you can do partially anomalous pulmonary venous drainage, subaortic membranes, mitrals, tricuspids, and plenty more when you get used to it. People have been maybe a bit put off by scars that grow or thoracic problems in the long term or issues with the breast, but actually it's been proven to be perhaps a superior approach if you're going to do redo surgery. Makes it simpler if you're then going to do a sternotomy in the future. So there's a lot of really good reasons to do this approach. So he's got a really good webinar from the presenters of the four videos that he also profiles in this series. So two of these videos show a vertical approach to an axillary thoracotomy, and the other show a horizontal version of the axillary approach for paediatric surgery. So in the first, Julie Klesiu from the German Heart Center in Munich demonstrates her technique for repairing a large secundum ASD using just fibrillatory arrest, which I thought was really nice. The second one, Ali Dodge-Katami from University Hospital in Aachen in Germany, shows tips and pitfalls when using right thoracotomy for closure of a membranous VSD. Again, a really nice video. And then Alexander Babliak from, amazingly, Kiev in Ukraine, showing again really, really high level surgery coming out of Ukraine, shows a challenging case of the repair of anomalous left coronary artery origin, Al-Kappa from the pulmonary artery, and a mitral valve repair in just a one-year-old girl, which I was really impressed with. And then, of course, our very own Sami Syed demonstrates their technique for repairing a sinus VSD and partially anomalous venous drainage connection using a two-patch technique, again through an axillary thoracotomy. So really, really nice, really interesting, and really cutting edge in congenital surgery. So well done to them. So that's all the videos and articles we've got for you. Keep a lookout for upcoming events. We've got the EAC segmentectomy webinar on Thursday, the September the 7th, coming up in just a couple of weeks' time. You can register online because it's a virtual course. Just check out the EAC website or check the links below. There's the 42nd Annual Cardiothoracic Surgery Symposium. The CREF is hosting this in San Diego and invites you to come and see all the exciting and interesting things going on with extracorporeal perfusion, ECMO, and the CME points available. Nurses, perfusionists, it's multidisciplinary. It's an in-person course. The other really, really cool thing that's coming up in Birmingham is the Birmingham Review course in its 30th year. If you're a resident or a trainee and you would like to know everything about cardiac, thoracic, congenital, transplant surgery, they have it all. It's a course run over 3 days about absolutely everything you could possibly want to know, with stellar speakers that have been doing it for many, many years. And finally, we have our last two items. Where is Diego, the roving thoracic surgery, going around the world in his amazing August tour? So he is now in Lima in Peru. So he's in South America for a few days, and he's done some VAT surgery there and some complex surgery, a really big right lower lobe tumour, and great job there. He's been posting, and all very successful cases. Well done to him. Fantastic. And finally, our honourable mention. Well, our honourable mention must go to Alan Carpentier. If I asked you who are the giants of cardiothoracic surgery, you'd probably say Michael DeBakey, Denton Cooley, and Alan Carpentier, perhaps. You know, they really are the true giants. And Alan Carpentier in Europe, you know, surely is our number one figure, with Magdi Yacoub, perhaps. He is the father of mitral valve repair surgery, undisputed, with the full set of repair techniques, which is amazing. Some people don't remember that actually he was the world's first person to do a robotic mitral repair back in 1998 with the Intuitive system, the Intuitive S, not even SI, you know, in its very rudimentary systems. You know, a quarter of a century ago, he was doing robotics. a lot of people don't realise, he worked for a lot of years on cardiomyoplasty, trying to work out ways to avoid transplantation by wrapping skeletal muscle around the heart and then trying to stimulate it at 60 to 80 beats a minute. And that didn't come to too much success, but he worked really, really hard on it. And then from that and his passion for research, he then went into total artificial hearts. And as you heard earlier in this podcast, in 2008, he started working on the CarMat, which is now in final stages of research and development. And I very, very much hope that it will become part of the armamentarium. I actually had a look at the CarMat website and it has a fascinating historical timeline all about the development of this total artificial heart, led by Alain Carpentier, the French surgeon, and it's a French product made by a French company. So well done, Alain Carpentier, a life of amazing development and innovation throughout his life and career, and an inspiration really to every mitral surgeon, transplant surgeon around the world. So that's everything for us on the podcast. Thank you. My name's Joel Dunning. It's been a pleasure being with you. Thank you for staying to the end, and tune in next week for another episode of the CTS NetBeat podcast.